Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and joining me is, of course, the inimitable Jeremy Goldcorn, man behind Danwei.org. How are you, Jeremy?
Very well. Good evening to you, Kaiser. It's been a long time since we've recorded the podcast together.
We skipped a couple of shows. The previous week, we had Thanksgiving together.
That was right.
Delicious. And then, Jeremy, you had a previously unscheduled trip to Australia.
Indeed.
And then I was actually down in the High in Shanghai, giving a talk to the Shanghai Foreign Correspondents Club on the ordinary night that we tape. That was lots of fun, but we're back and we have shows lined up for the next couple of weeks already, so we will keep you in podcasts all December. Please remember that you can follow us on Facebook and keep the conversation going there. We are at facebook.com/SenecaPodcast, all one word. So today's show is a melancholy one. We say a fond farewell to our dear friend Will Moss, known by his nom de blog, Image Thief. Will and his family will be leaving China next month after 8.5 years here. He arrived in China on June 6th, 2004, and in the time since, he's lived in both Beijing and Shanghai, writing one of the best loved and certainly most humorous English language blogs and appearing on Seneca at least half a dozen times. Oh, probably a dozen or more times. You've been on here.
Plenty of times. I've lost count. And by the way, so long, suckers.
Anyway, it's great to have you, Will. And
nice to be back.
We're very sad to be seeing you leaving. When do you actually leave?
January 11th, we're on the airplane.
Wow, January 11th.
I know. It's very, very, very soon in the cosmic scheme of things.
It is. It's frighteningly soon. And are we going to have a grand send-off for you?
Well, I'm hoping to have a grand send-off. I haven't actually had the wherewithal to plan a grand send-off, but, you know, some send-off may be
in the offing. Let's get on it. I mean, we'll start planning as soon as we're done recording here.
Excellent.
So, I mean, in your time here, it must be said that you have elevated the hackneyed genre, that most despised of genres, the expat grumble post, to something of a high art. What's your secret, man?
I like to think of myself as a very high-class pisser and moaner. Honestly, there's nothing wrong with complaining. Complaining is fun. Complaining is how we deal with things psychologically. If we weren't in China, we'd be complaining about whatever we were encountering wherever we lived. It wouldn't matter. We could have all the money in the world. We could live in fabulous mansions, drive sports cars, and date supermodels. We would complain about our sports cars, supermodels, and mansions. That's what we would do.
Right.
What makes complaining tolerable, I think, is if there's affection underneath it.
Yeah, and there is. There's always sort of this good spirit, this sort of gentleness of spirit there that shows this good-natured kind of – I mean, you never poke really mean fun at things.
I've had my moments.
And humor, Will. I mean, let's be honest. You're a funny writer. So
thank you.
You can say a lot of very rude things, and we will forgive you because you're funny.
That's good. I should write a post about you.
Perhaps not.
So, well, you did recently write a post, your valedictory post, I guess, on Image Thief, that actually got so many hits when you tweeted about it that your server crashed. I mean, did you see the stats for it? How many times did that thing get read?
Well, I would like to say that it was slash dotted and all the people in the world came and visited it. Part of the problem was that at the exact moment I published it, the hard disk filled up. So that was a big reason why it went down. It's been read about 8,000 times.
Oh, okay. All right.
So not like hundreds of thousands. The most read post ever on Image Thief was Edison Chen's dirty photos at 100,000 page views. So we're a long ways from hitting that point.
That was funny, though. That was a classic, though.
I'd like to believe that everybody who came to that post came for the wit. But in fact, I'm pretty sure that 99,000 came for right. photographs, which were not on that post. So I'm sorry, folks. Keep looking.
Right, right, right. So, I mean, tell us about the whole process of deciding how to approach the valedictory post. In light of the more infamous flounces that we've seen by the way.
Perhaps you should explain the context for people who may have just started listening to the podcast and not be aware of this year's history
right.
of leaving China.
Let's
fill us in, Jeremy. Fill us in.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'll fill you in. So there were two posts that if you are an expatriate concerned with the media or blogs or the internet, you almost certainly will have read this year. Both were, in fact, by friends of mine. So one was Mark Kitto, an Englishman who's lived in China for a long time and started many businesses. And he, writing in Prospect magazine, wrote a post saying, titled "Why I'll Never Be Chinese," detailing his dissatisfaction with China and how he had once been in love I think was the word he used with his country, but he gradually became disillusioned, and he detailed the reasons for his disillusionment. And just a few days later, I think, after Mark Kiddo's post was published, Charlie Custer, who's also been on this podcast and runs the China Geeks blog, wrote a fairly similar post, and also about his reasons for leaving China, and they were also reasons connected with basically the entire fabric of society.
And his very public contretemps with
Young Ray, host.
He took pains to say that had nothing to do with his departure, but it had been a very public in our circle, spat shortly before his departure.
By even mentioning it, it sort of drew attention to the fact that, yes, there was this, after all.
That's right.
So then you came along.
There were a couple of others in between.
Those were the big ones, and what was interesting was those two posts, just two, kindled a couple of things. One was this huge round of chatter in our particular corner of the internet, Chinese Twitter sphere.
Which matters so very much.
Right. Globally influential as we are. And then also, surprisingly enough, in the mainstream media. So Bloomberg Businessweek, The New York Times, and The Economist all wrote stories on the departures of Mark and Charlie and what it said about foreigners in China. And while I recognize that you can take both of their stories to illustrate larger points on China, the plural of anecdote, as we all know, is not data. And two guys leaving noisily, guys that, by the way, I'm friends with both of them as well. They're great guys. They both have interesting things to say about China. But this sort of mini hysteria that blew up that foreigners were leaving China, it was ridiculous.
Yep.
And so, one, this outburst of speculation that, you know, China was becoming inhospitable to foreigners and foreigners were leaving. And also the fact that there were these two high-profile I'm leaving posts or articles that were both quite negative made me think it was time for a different take on the departure.
So for those of us who haven't read, or those people who listen who haven't read your take, what was that take?
Well, the premise and the title are I'm leaving China and it doesn't mean a thing. There's no greater meaning. I'm not, you know, there's nothing chasing me out of China. I haven't had a miserable experience. It's not the fabric of society. None of that stuff is responsible for my leaving. My leaving has, and I think we can all agree on this, no significance in the greater scheme of things. And in fact, in 8 years here, despite all of the noisy and I hope humorous complaining, I've become very affectionate for Beijing. And I've enjoyed my life here tremendously. And I leave with great nostalgia for Beijing and dare I say love for Beijing?
Jeremy?
Does I love for Beijing? Is that what you're answering? Do I have love for Beijing?
Of course we do.
Yes.
Go ahead. Confess.
Do I love Beijing? I have a love-hate relationship with Beijing.
It's safe to say we all do on some level, but love is a part of it.
Yeah, love is a big part of it. I mean, I've been here 17 years. Right. I'm not here because anyone's forcing me to stay here. There's plenty of other places I could go, which have a far more pleasant lifestyle. So, yes, I'm a bit uncomfortable with saying I love Beijing because it sounds to me a little, it verges to me on like, war I Beijing Tiananmen, it verges to me on I love my country, I love China. It reminds me of, you know, the Chaguar Lao She, the tea house where there's this character who says, I love the country who loves me. And, you know, I mean, China gives me that feeling. So I find the word love problematic. I have a great deal of affection for China and
for
Beijing.
I was torn between those two words.
And I'm very interested in China, and I'm very interested in Beijing, and I find living in Beijing fascinating. I have great friends here, and I personally have had a very rewarding experience living here. I don't think love is actually the right word for what I feel to Beijing, though.
Indeed.
I don't quibble. I mean, love is certainly in my vocabulary when it comes to Beijing. I mean, there's nothing else that accurately describes my feelings.
I love my wife. I don't love Beijing.
Right.
But
I love my Beijing.
That doesn't mean
I love your wife too, but for totally different reasons. and best to her, by the way. There was another point I wanted to make in the post, though, which was while I thought it was ridiculous to get all worked up about the departures of Mark and Charlie, much as I like both of them, I do think there's something happening with the foreigner community here, or a particular segment of the foreigner community. There's a generational change happening. There are many people that I know who have left, are thinking about leaving, talking about leaving, including many people that I never expected to hear that from. Mm-hmm. So I have no doubt in my mind that there is, amongst a certain segment of the foreigner population here, a move out of Beijing. The thing is, I don't think it's sinister in any way. I think it's largely generational. Most of the people who are going through this, including me, people about my age, in their 40s, have kids and have seemed to have just reached a stage in life where it makes sense to think beyond Beijing because they are not Chinese and you have to make a choice at some point.
Right. I mean, it'd be different in my case because I'm quasi-Chinese. But even me, yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely considering the possibilities when it comes time for my kids to go to high school. I mean, I certainly want to send them to college in the States. And being that I'm father to a girl, of course I want to be there at least for her first couple of years. And maybe even high school. I mean, I think we're even talking about the possibility of seeing if I can work half the year in the States out of our office in Silicon Valley.
Well, I would encourage that.
Yeah, that would be great.
We could entirely unselfish reasons.
We could hang out and reminisce.
Exactly.
That would be fun. But I think that part of it is just people move around. I mean, we came here. People didn't write essays about the fact that we were leaving the United States. I mean, it's just not – people move. I mean, we're expatriates. We
It's a transient community by
definition.
Exactly.
It's inherently transient. I mean,
and more so here than in many places. I had many friends who settled in Singapore when I lived there, and who I don't think will leave. And for a long time, I thought that's where I would go back to when I left China because I'm married into Singapore and I'm a Singapore resident. Singapore invites foreigners to make it home in the long term in a way that China simply does not.
Right.
China does not invite foreigners to settle here forever. It goes out of its way to keep us at arm's length. And so the foreign community here is transient in a way that it wouldn't be, say, in the United States or London or Singapore or many other places where long-term immigration and settlement are, if not encouraged, at least a fact of life.
Right. So, Will, you're one of a group of Westerners living in China, if I may be also bold too. I mean, in part maybe because of the nature of your work doing public relations, and in part because of your naturally occurring intellect.
My awesomeness, I like to say.
Right, your awesomeness. Well, you've become a China watcher, let's face it. You're a China watcher, in particular somebody who reads an awful lot of English language reportage on China. So here at the end of your 8.5 years, would you talk a little bit about how you think coverage has changed or if coverage of China has changed in the Western
– Sure.
I mean, I use the word – let's say the Anglophone – ex-China Anglophone media.
The awesomeness thing was a joke, by the way, just in case anybody's getting their hate mail ready. I do think it's changed. For one thing, China's stature has changed a great deal. China's stature in the world has changed a great deal in the last decade. That is an obvious thing. So that's played out in two ways in the mainstream media. One is that the economic pressures, at least on American mainstream media, have thinned out a lot of the bureaus, particularly the smaller ones and the sort of regional or municipal broadsheet bureaus. You know, there are fewer of them, I think, than there used to be. But the big national papers, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journals, they've invested a great deal more resources over the year, it seems, in covering China than they used to.
Right. I mean, incredible talent there.
They've really staffed up. They have a lot of talent here, and they're doing a lot of reporting on China. And recently, I think, a lot of very good reporting on China. So
I'm getting at is, I mean, what about the tone of coverage? Do you think that they're – I mean, I've heard it observed, and I think I would share this idea that – there's been a certain evaporation of empathy that was once there. I mean, that 8 years ago, if you had looked, you know, if you roll back the clock to 2006 or 2004, and you look at what was being written about China, there were a lot more people willing to sort of cut the leadership slack. They're steering an extremely rickety ship. These are essentially smart and essentially well-intentioned technocrats who have a formidable, you know, job to do.
And I'm not sure I agree with that entirely.
Okay.
I think China has always gotten some credit and has gotten some criticism. I think the nature of both has evolved as time has gone by. It seems to me that the government here got got friendlier treatment from the Western press in the Jiang Zemin days, possibly simply because he was a more charismatic figure than Hu Jintao was.
Oh my God. Which is,
you know, not a difficult thing to achieve, I think. China always came in for a fair amount of criticism. Even in the early days I was here, was getting criticism for human rights, was getting criticism for censorship pretty extensively. What emerged over the past few years was this sense that the sense of the as the U.S. went into its economic problems was this idea of the technocratic supremacy or possibly the meritocracy. And this idea that the Chinese government was getting things done that we couldn't be successful at. Tom Friedman visited this theme a few times. Daniel Bell has obviously hit on this theme. But that emerged much more recently, I think, in counterpoint to our own economic problems in the U.S. and our sense of political drift. But at the same time, a growing awareness of China's stature as our geopolitical rival and the collision of its interests with ours, and a much more fear in our coverage of China than there used to be.
I would attribute it. I mean, I do see that the overall sort of tone of coverage has gotten more critical. I think I would lay the blame for this very squarely at the feet of the minders of the journalists here. I think we're caught in this sort of vicious cycle whereby the worst treatment that journalists receive has, I mean, with visa problems constantly now, with you know, more frequent visitations and so forth, that begets worse coverage, which then begets worse treatment. And so I feel like we're locked in something of a downward spiral right now. And I know where the blame originates. Jeremy,
I think that's true. But I mean, I used to say that the only people left living in a really totalitarian society in China were foreign journalists in the diplomatic compounds a few years ago. I mean, of course, that's not true. There are people who are treated far worse. But being followed around, being bugged, being monitored, I mean, that's been a fact of life for foreign journalists. I mean, to get a J visa is not that different now from what you had to go through, you know, 20 years ago, whereas to get a business visa, to get a tourist visa is much, much simpler and easier than it used to be. So I think that is one factor. But I mean, I think there was a flip after 2008. And I think the global financial crisis and China's emergence as, you know, relatively unscathed led to a number of things, one of which was much more swagger on the part of government officials. And I think that was noticed by a lot of journalists.
Sure.
And whereas before, you know, they felt that they might have a sympathetic ear, or they suddenly felt that now they were being talked down to. And I think, you know, perhaps an article that crystallized this feeling was James McGregor, the author of 1 Billion Customers and more recently of No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, a very experienced journalist and businessman in China, wrote an article titled, the premise was China used to be a closed system with open minds, and
right,
it's become an open system with closed minds. And I think that's certainly, there's quite a bit of truth in that. It's compounded by the fact that for a lot of foreigners, whereas really up until about 2008, you know, with a white face, you could basically get an invitation into, you know, the highest, the corridors of power, that's no longer the case. The people in the government and regular Chinese people don't really, they're not so impressed by foreigners anymore. And it's also come at the same time that, there's been the advance of the state, the Guojin Mintui, where state-owned enterprises have become much more powerful and no longer need to cooperate with foreigners to understand.
You're deep into McGregor land. Practices.
Right. So, but I mean, all these things have been happening at the same time. So they're all factors that affect the way foreigners who live in China feel about the place. And then, you know, at the same time, you have a city like Beijing, in terms of lifestyle, becoming a lot less pleasant. These things all affect people who live here and the way they write about the place and their sentiments.
But there's also editorial lines at work, and that's always influenced the coverage that's come out as well. Kaiser, you mentioned the miners a few minutes ago, and that does play an important role in how the coverage is shaped, both because certain publications are prone to take a more negative approach to China, and certainly many journalists I've spoken to here have complained to me, I won't mention any names because I don't want to get them in trouble, about the degree to which their foreign desks or foreign editors do or don't understand China and the kind of things they get dispatched to cover. That's not universally true. Some of the foreign desks are now being run by China veterans who have a pretty good understanding of what's happening here. But certainly, I've had many journalists over the years say to me, I can't believe the stuff I'm being asked to cover.
Sure, me too. I hear this all the time. Yeah, so yeah, part of it is the editorial line they're getting back from New York or from D.C. Interesting.
And part of it is, welcome to the world, China. Deal. Yeah. Just f***ing deal. I mean, if you're going to run a place where you like lock up people who, you know, people like, you know, Chen Guangcheng and, you know, then punish their nephews, I mean, I'm sorry, you know, welcome to the 21st century.
Ladies and
gentlemen,
that Jeremy Goldthorne, he's back.
That kind of activity is just not acceptable in other countries. And, I mean, to the extent that China is now a place that deserves significant coverage, even though it doesn't always get it, in global media, it is going to be held to a great extent to international standards. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, we thought it was great when, you know, 2003, the Nanfang Zhongmuo covered the death by cop of Sun Zhigang,
yeah,
the graphic designer, and we thought that was great. That was cutting edge. Look where the Chinese media is going. It's starting to reveal corruption. 10 years later, we've got Weibo, but the restrictions have not been lightened.
The Southern Group is still extraordinarily brave, and we still see a lot of exceptionally good investigative journalism by
of course we do, but many of the reporters and editors who have been responsible for the brave stuff get sidelined, and it's the system is not getting any better in that regard.
So back to how foreign media...
So we used to have... Sorry, just one more thought. People used to be more hopeful about certain aspects of the development of China. And probably that was misguided. And, you know, we may get onto the discussion of the new lot and of Xi Jinping a bit later, and possibly the hopes invested in them are misguided. But I think that certainly in the foreign press, there used to be much more of a sympathetic look at the Chinese government and a feeling that, well, you know, it's a tough situation. And
that's exactly what I was saying, right.
There seems to be a shift in the overall expectations from the foreign media of what China is. And 8 or 10 years ago, it seems to me that China was still looked at very much as a developing country that could be forgiven developing country flaws, for lack of a better word. Whereas now, particularly because of a lot of things that have happened in the few years since the American economic crisis, it's seen as a developed country in a lot of ways and held to, you know, Western ideas of what a developed country should be. And that is perhaps, not perhaps, that is misplaced in a way. Mm-hmm. Certainly parts of China are developed, but if you look at the country as a whole, if you look at the political system as a whole, if you look at the media as a whole, there is a long way to go on many fronts.
We've talked an awful lot about how Weibo and other social media platforms have changed China itself or changed policy on the show. We've talked an awful lot about that. But, you know, another concurrent phenomenon, I mean, much smaller, of course, in scale, is the fact that all the journalists are on Twitter all day long. And you, all three of us here, we're part of that conversation. We
Seriously,
watch.
How are any of us getting any work done?
I mean, this is part of my work and part of your work too. I mean,
That's
what I tell people. But and Jeremy, what's your excuse?
I don't tell people anything. I don't have a boss. I can do whatever the fuck I want.
I'm curious whether you guys have any thoughts about how that fact, how the real interconnectedness of the journalist community here has perhaps changed coverage. Are people more critical of one another? Do they call each other? Do you feel like the fact that there are so many eyes on it, on every piece, has raised the standard of writing? I think probably the effect has been a good one. My personal sense is that there are people out there, you know, the Bill Bishops of the world, for example, who are ready to call bullshit on any story that they think is poorly sourced or where they've gotten things wrong. And it seems to have, I mean, and the journalists reading one another as well through the – and immediately. I mean, because as soon as somebody publishes a piece, they tweet about it, right?
Boy, I think that would be a great question to address to one of those journalists and see what they think about it.
Well, I mean, the three of us all watched them very, very carefully, and my sense is that it's had a very beneficial impact.
I wonder about that. I think it's been useful in terms of allowing us to engage with the journalists and engage with those stories and discuss them and share them, and that's all been great. I do think it's good that there's an avenue for criticism and discussion of stories. I am skeptical as to what degree it's actually influenced the quality of coverage. I think it's influenced the nature of coverage in terms of how the media are co-opting Twitter, co-opting online video, co-opting blogs into their coverage to be better connected with all of us who are on the tubes. I'm not sure that it's elevated the standard mainstream reporting.
Jeremy, your sense of this?
Well, I think there's more information out there. So I think that has contributed to a better coverage, broader coverage.
Choice is good. The choice is good.
Voices. I think that the mainstream media has got more comfortable with the internet. I mean, when I started Dunway in 2003, I used to regularly see, you know, sentences that we'd translated appear in some of the finest publications in America and Europe, who I will not name at this point, unattributed. And they used to just steal the stuff because at that time, you know, there wasn't a convention of attributing to the internet. And, you know, that was fine. Now, not only do they tend more often to attribute their sources, but they're also looking at a much greater range of stuff. So they're looking at blogs, they're looking at Twitter, they're looking at Weibo, they're looking at Chinese media. I do think that has had a beneficial effect.
A salubrious effect on us, yeah. Yeah. Very much so.
I mean, it also, it's not all good. You get a lot of this kind of Twitter-style reporting where you don't really have to do any work. You just sit at your desk and then you cherry-pick a few quotes. I mean, that's not good either.
There's plenty of crap still out there.
There's plenty of crap. But I think that along with the rising tide of shit, which is the fate of humanity, you have, you know, on top of the rising tide of shit, you have a few boats of
quality
coverage.
Sorry, this metaphor is going nowhere.
Right, yeah.
Follow through. Go all the way.
So I'm thinking of the Tidy Bowl man here now. Listen, before I do want to talk a little bit about the new leadership, the transition, and let Will go out on a serious note here. But before
please,
we do
what for?
Please. And you're doing that. Why?
But before we do that, I want to talk to you about one of the things that you're sort of known for among your friends is these sort of epic pedestrian treks around our fair city. I mean, you've done this an awful lot, and you've actually, you know, tweeted from various way stations along the way and talked about it. Let's talk about, you know, Will Moss on foot in Beijing. What is it that you feel like you've gotten from this? I mean, taking that, you know, there's that famous Chinese saying, one doesn't look at flowers from horseback. So you're down there on street level and you're looking at
Well, first of all, I think it's worth pointing out that you have two hikers in the room. Jeremy is the rural hiker. He's always off in the hills doing his thing out there. I've joined him once or twice. Hard to keep up, I assure you. And I'm an urban hiker. I like to walk through cities. And I've done it several times in Beijing, as you pointed out, 20, 30 kilometers at a time, often trying to transit the whole city. I like it for a few reasons. I think that saying captures a big part of it. But the other thing is it's trying not to allow the city to become so familiar that I become contemptuous of it or that I take it for granted. Part of the secret to staying affectionate about Beijing is trying to reacquaint yourself with it and not just allowing yourself to fall in the rhythm of the same old things all the time. And for me, the walks were a way to do that. They allowed me to – when I walk across the city, a few things happen. I always see things I've never seen before. I always find neighborhoods or scenes or sites I've never encountered before. I always find some new aspect of the city that I haven't seen. It's a neighborhood, it's a feeling, it's a collection of people, whatever it is. They're just things I don't think I would encounter if I wasn't out there on foot bushwhacking across the city. And I'll give you an example. One of the walks I did recently, I live on Dawanglu near Shin Kong Place on the east side of the Central Business District. And many times my walks take me by different routes from there to the northwest, somewhere up around Beida or the Summer Palace. And over the summer, I tried to follow canals all the way. Mm-hmm. My goal was to follow canals as much as possible from where I live up to the Summer Palace.
And canals in the summer, I mean, they're an olfactory assault.
Yes. I know that well from running along the canals. But that wasn't the thing. The thing was, it's a challenge. You can't follow the canals all the way. So there's places where you have to sort of – you have to bushwhack a little bit.
Sure.
But it was fun. Some of the canal neighborhoods are lovely. They're just beautiful. There's these little tucked away stretches of Beijing's canals, as nasty as they can be. There are these marvelous, peaceful, tucked away stretches that are lined by houses and shaded by trees. They're intimate. And they're just beautiful little areas. And there'll be a few fishermen there. And you just would never know they're there unless you're striking out along these pathways.
And isn't that sort of part of the joy of Beijing? Because if this was a European city, that would be where all the rich people lived. There would be cafes, and it would be great. It would be beautiful. It would be more beautiful than it is in Beijing. But it would kind of be, it's gentrified and kind of boring. Whereas in Beijing, what should be the jewel of the city is kind of a secret.
It's a byway.
That only you and a few select others stumble upon.
Yeah, and it was wonderful to find these areas and to know that they're there. Now, parts of the canal are miserable, and I wouldn't recommend that anybody walk along them, but finding that out is part of the adventure as well.
Sure. You do these solo.
I've done many of them solo, which is not a bad way to do them because I've done them with people as well, and that's fun. But when you're with somebody, you tend to focus on them and you're talking or whatever.
Right.
And when you are by yourself, you tend to focus on where you are and what you're looking at and what you see. And by the way, in Beijing, it's not hard to do this. You're never more than two blocks away from a snack stall.
Exactly. There's Jianbing stations
all over. Or a public bathroom or whatever. And it's just not that hard to walk across the city and keep yourself in provisions all the way. I highly recommend it as a way to explore the city. And it's something that I will miss a great deal when I leave.
And we're going to miss that about you too. I mean, reading about your treks, these were some of my favorite posts. I hope you'll send us links to specific stories about some of the walks that you've taken, where you've mapped them especially, so that people might walk in your footsteps.
Let me see if I can do that. I definitely have maps of some of them online.
That would be great. That would be great. So one thing that I want to do now, we'll revisit Will and say our proper goodbye. But one topic that I wanted to touch on today, in his speech on the final day of the 18th Party Congress, Xi Jinping mentioned on more than a few occasions a phrase. He said, "The great renewal of the Chinese nation." And then a few days later, on November 19th, that was just a couple of days ago, at the Beijing National Museum, he visited an exhibition titled "The Road to National Renewal." The word renewal, Fuxing, has been translated as renaissance or renewal. There's all sorts of debate over how it should be. Renewal is good enough. We'll stick with that for now. The great renewal of the Chinese nation. Again, he mentions this. Does it mean something this time, and just what does it mean?
No, it doesn't mean anything. Xi Jinping has got in. The new broom is going to sweep clean. And I think one could perhaps say something is meaningful about the anti-corruption drive that seems to be going on. I'm sure he does definitely seem to be trying to make his mark. But using this phrase and visiting an exhibition of appalling revisionist history to me means nothing. I would, in fact, say if the Chinese is Fuxing, but if you don't read pinyin, you might pronounce it as Fuxing, or if you were German, the great the Chinese people. I would say this is basically so I'm gonna, what one could read from this. That it's an empty catchphrase, no more meaningful than He Xie Shou Hui.
Oh, yeah, I think that, I completely disagree with you. I completely disagree with you.
Let's see some action, Mr. Xi. I don't care. Visit an exhibition of appalling revisionist history.
It's early days right now, but I think that they choose their language very deliberately. They don't haul these phrases out just for no reason at all. I think that there's an element here, first, of declaring one's intention for a kind of moral renewal. I think you can read into it an admission for the need for such renewal. It really refers to the ongoing process of renewal that, you know, in CCP historiography started with Communist Revolution and then was given new impetus and new direction with the reform and opening in 1979, again in 1992 with Deng's southern tour. All of these things, in each case, this phrase is invoked with greater frequency. I think that we're seeing that. Now, another important piece of it is economic. I really believe this, that we're going to see maybe a reprise of the southern tour, another southern tour moment. We're reading today in Duowei, I'm not sure how accurate this is, that he's planning a sort of high-profile trip to Shenzhen. I think it may be a reversal of the assertive SOEs that we've seen since 2006, more of a deepened commitment to reform. And
well, let's see is all I can say. I just think that you shouldn't say because he's using these words, know what these words mean. When Hu Jintao started using harmonious society, there were many different interpretations, some of which were charitable and some of which were not.
Right. Well,
let's his word. Let's see what he does.
There's one more dimension to this. There's one more dimension to this that maybe perhaps isn't as rosy a picture. So it has that moral dimension to it, perhaps an economic commitment. But there's also sort of the geopolitical component to it. When you talk about, I mean, it is a sort of assertively nativist or assertively nationalist expression as well, renewal of the Chinese people. I think that what we can understand from this perhaps is that this is also going to be a deepening commitment to a more assertive China on an international stage.
I don't mean to seem gloomy, but that seems to me to be the aspect of it that we'll be most likely to see realized.
Okay.
Because it will in some ways be the easiest to implement and the one that will play out possibly the best at home. And it's the one that we've seen distinct signs of in recent months.
I mean, it's too early to attribute those to Xi himself.
Is it?
I think so. I think that what we've seen in the Diaoyu conflict and in the South China Sea is still sort of legacy policy from the preceding administration. I'm not sure that we are ready to make a call on that, but it wouldn't surprise me at all.
For me, I am definitely not ready to make a call on whether what Xi says means X, Y, or Z, left or right, pro or against.
Right.
I do think that he has to bring in a set of vocabulary that will be associated with his policies. But the vocabulary and the policies and the implementation of those policies are three completely separate things.
I think that we've almost never seen a complete divorce between the main rhetorical feature in a new policy prescription and an actual policy on the ground. We've not seen that.
But the rhetoric rhetoric itself tends to be so broad as to allow many things to be put underneath.
I think in this case there's actually very specific things that it means. I think that it has these dimensions to it. It means we're ready to break the eggs to make this omelet to attack corruption, the moral renewal part of it. There's the economic commitment to it, and there's that sort of nationalistic component to it.
But there's not any idea of reform or liberalization.
Well, I don't believe in reform and liberalization as a meaningful term. I mean, it's not just simply – we don't bifurcate the world in Chinese politics between simply reform meaning commitment to both economic reform and political reform and also sort of to a more internationalist view in foreign policy or a more sort of a less hawkish view. I think you can have any combination of those three. There are people who are committed economic reformers who may be the most hawkish in terms of comes to foreign policy or who may be adamantly opposed to touching politics while they're, you know, completely willing to be neoliberal in their economic approach.
I agree 100%, but that's why I don't think we can meaningfully understand what Xi means by visiting the Road to Revival exhibition and using this phrase, because we don't know, you know, those different things, where on the spectrum he lies right now, and even more importantly, what he's going to do. We don't know. All we know is these words, and these words are just words.
And Will, you're going to miss out on all this fun.
Oh, no, I'll have Seneca and cynicism to keep me up to date.
Cynicism or cynicism?
Cynicism. Well, cynicism, depending on how you read it from day to day.
Well, you better have some cynicism if you want to make sure you know what's going on.
Okay, folks. Let's take some time to make some recommendations for this, and then say our proper goodbye to Will Moss. Will, why don't you go first?
All right. I'm going to recommend China because it's my last recommendation, so I'm going to be all-encompassing. But let me make a little bit more specific. If you're a Seneca listener and you've been thinking about spending time in China, living or working in China, stop screwing around and do it. China is still a fascinating place to live and work. Stop dreaming, buy the plane ticket, come here, get to know some people, and learn a little bit about China firsthand. And if you're already here, well, congratulations to you. But I think it's still a country very much worth getting to know firsthand, and especially for young people who have been thinking about it. Stop thinking and put it into practice. That's my advice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I third that recommendation.
You know, terrific. Great
China,
recommendation.
You're great. I love you.
Wait, there it is. There it is.
We've come for it. For it.
No, I really do agree. My recommendations, two of them. One, first, all hail Azure Winged Magpie, who has not had a mention on Seneca for a long time. And, you know, I moved house recently, and I would like to say that the area between the Agricultural Exhibition Center and Chaoyang Park is full of Azure Winged Magpies.
One of the few animals that can tough out the Dongbei winter.
Yes. But connection with that, there's a Facebook page called Beijing Birding if you're a bird watcher. It's, you know, pretty geeky stuff if you're not a bird watcher, but if you are, you might want to check that out.
Calling Jonathan Franzen.
And the second recommendation is probably familiar to a lot of our listeners, but I think it's time for me to just come out and say that at the moment, the best English language blog about China, I think, it's got to be Beijing Cream.
I love Beijing Cream.
Great
is,
stuff. Great
you
stuff.
Know, started off, I think, a bit all over the place, but they're kind of finding their voice. And I mean, it can be quite a mean voice at times, but very, very funny and
very
informative.
It's funny as hell. It's
like the Shanghaiist with a baseball bat with nails driven through it.
Yeah, it's the edgy version. It's the northern edgy version of Shanghaiist.
Yeah. But, yeah, you know,
but who is this mysterious Anthony Dao character?
Anthony Dao and the RFH, you know, on the internet.
Come, you know, drop me an email. Come hang out on Seneca with me. That'd be fun. You guys are great. We love what you're doing. My recommendation is a little more, you know, wonky. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to. We have Mark Leonard coming on the show very, very soon. If not this coming week, I'm not sure when we'll broadcast, but we're recording this weekend and we'll broadcast either next Friday or the following. Mark is, of course, the author of What China Thinks, which was a book where he looked at a lot of think tankers and public intellectuals, and I think, you know, it was a good contribution. It came in for a lot of bruising from certain quarters, but I rather liked it. He's come out with a new volume with the European Council on Foreign Relations. It's called China 3.0. And it's a compendium of writings. Now, this isn't Mark writing at this point. It's writings by a lot of public intellectuals and, again, think tankers, spanning the political spectrum, the economic spectrum, the sort of geopolitical spectrum.
And all Chinese ones.
And all Chinese, right. I mean, so a lot of familiar names for people. The so-called neo-leftist Wang Hui has a very, very good piece in there. Wang Jisi is in there. Hu Shuli, the editor of Caixin magazine. A lot of people who you might not have heard of and whose ideas are quite good. You get a good sense for the spectrum of thought happening right now, and he sort of puts out a model which I think is more useful in plotting people and, you know, where they fit on an ideological mapping of China a lot more useful than the kind of simple ones that we've been bandying about before. Anyway, we really look forward to having Mark on. I hope you listen to that show. And please do read this. I'll put a link to where you can download the free PDF. It's about 140 pages or so. It's really a very worthwhile read. The essays are quite short, and there are quite a few of them. So, Will, your last words... Your last words before you. I don't have a gun actually held to his head.
Palo Alto is death.
Right. Well, that's what they tell me, particularly level.
You'll be back, right? I mean, they all come back. We'll be back.
I've been here too long to stay away forever. My son was born here. He's a Beijing native. We have a connection to Beijing and to China that will never go away, and we'll be back.
We're really glad to hear that because, I mean, you've been a dear friend. You're going to be very, very badly missed by lots of us. And we're going to throw you a hell of a party before you leave.
Thank you. I'll miss you guys. I'm leaving China in your good hands. Don't screw it up.
We'll do our best not to. And meanwhile, we will. Look, I mean, it's too late. My damage has been done. I've brought way too much spiritual pollution to this country to ever atone for. And Jeremy, you've done worse.
I've done nothing wrong. Yeah. Been minding my own business.
Okay. So, bye, Will.
Bye,
thanks
guys.
For coming on.
Yeah, cheers, Will. Good luck in California, where, you know, I think I would just like to say people call China the Far East, but if you go east from China, you eventually get to California. And China's taken me maybe almost 20 years to start feeling that I even maybe understand a little corner of it. But America is truly the exotic country.
Really?
Well, so one last thing on that. My mother, who lives in Palo Alto and is a wonderful woman who's helping us a great deal with this move, has also reached that age where change is not necessarily a good thing. So I hope she's not listening to this because I'll be in trouble. But there's one thing that she has mentioned to me many times on recent visits. She's like, so many Chinese people in Palo Alto. So many Chinese people. This house is Chinese. That house is Chinese. There's so many Chinese people in Palo Alto. I'm like... Mom,
it's going to feel like home.
I got news for you. You're connected to China, too, so get used to it.
Hey, so we will see you guys next week, and take care. Bye-bye.